I would like to ask you to, because this is being recorded, I would like to ask the speakers to repeat the question before they answer it. Also, I mentioned that Deborah Ellis, who is going to be on the Audacity of Hope, the U.S. boat in the Free Gaza Flotilla, which is leaving shortly, has asked people to write letters to send to Gaza. And also I'm asking Talia, who is a Resource Center for Nonviolence intern, and Kathleen Eschenpipes, who is recently in Israel and Palestine for a conference, to pass a bucket to take up donations for the flotilla. I also have a sign-up sheet. So I guess I'll just turn it back over to Sherratt and Maxine to take questions. And then there will be a reception after.
I just wanted to say that if anybody wants to, you know, later on, I can show it. I have a few short video clips of the protests in Tahrir.
Ooh, yeah.
Yes.
I'm wondering what, you know, when the revolution first started, Obama was supportive of it in his speeches. So do you believe that the U.S. had a role in the military not cracking down on the protesters like they did historically in the last 30 years?
Yeah. Well, Yes, you're correct that, you know, when the uprising first started, and Hillary Clinton said that the Mubarak regime is essentially stable, so she really wanted it to remain in place. I mean, that was the real U.S. interest. As far as the military not cracking down or not using force against the protesters, my belief is that I think that the U.S. played a very minimal role in that. I think that the military itself, the military leadership was smart enough to understand that and to try to, first of all, distance itself from the internal security forces, the police, and especially the secret police, because they understood the public opinion. And they understood that the military's public opinion of the military was untainted till now, and that they could play a role in sort of being the power broker during the transition period, if it came to that. So I think that the military had already figured that out. As far as the U.S. role is concerned, it's very interesting what's happening now, because what the U.S. government is doing is, I mean, one of these, in fact, this fellow Ahmed Saleh, who is in the U.S. and whom I showed you there with a broken nose. Now, he actually had requested a meeting with the U.S. Department of Defense, because what he's asking for is he's trying to get some leverage, try to use the U.S. government to apply some kind of leverage on the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in Egypt, because what he wants is that the Supreme Council open up more to stop repression. That just the other day, some journalists, a friend of mine, Hossam al-Hamalawi, who's the editor of the English version of the newspaper Al-Basri Al-Yom, that's a web version. So he was called before a military judge for criticizing the military. What a lot of the youth people are doing is saying that, look, the military has to allow democracy to take place and stop the killings in Tahrir Square or the killings of protesters that we've now have several dozen people who have been killed after February 11th, and stop these, stop intimidating people who are criticizing the military. His objective is to, okay, go through the U.S. Defense Department, since Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. military aid, $1.3 billion a year since 1979, and try to get them to force the Egyptian military to make these kinds of concessions. The response he got from DOD, as the Deputy Secretary of Defense, was that, well, we can't really do very much, and we're not going to do very much. Okay, The interesting thing is that the opponents, the protesters, are actually getting more support from a very different quarter, a very surprising quarter. Okay, this George Bush, George W. Bush, the younger one, is setting up his presidential library in Dallas on the campus of the Southern Methodist University. And he's already got something known as the Bush Institute. It's already up and running. And on April 26th, the Bush Institute held a conference. Condoleezza Rice was there, and several of the Egyptian activists, the youth activists. I'm not talking about the traditional opposition. Youth activists were invited to that conference, and where Condoleezza Rice and others actually gave them support and said that, you know, we believe in your movement for democracy.
Of course they don't.
What they want to do is to co-opt it and also to lay the groundwork for a future Republican administration, okay, to have some kind of strings, okay, on these youth leaders. Now, it isn't that these youth leaders are going to win the September elections. Okay, that's not realistic. But once the Constituent Assembly starts to meet and it rewrites the Constitution, if the new Constitution sets forth a parliamentary form of government, okay, at the very least, what will happen is that it's possible that a coalition will be required to form a government under a parliamentary system. And some of these youth leaders could be in that government. And so this is what. So it's interesting how the Republicans are trying to position themselves to control the strings here in a future Egypt. So this is something to that we should, you know, be aware of. Yes.
What's your understanding of the current status of like the security forces and the police? Are they kind of just lying low? Or are they actually being dismantled?
What has happened is that some elements of the security apparatus have been sort of dismantled, like for example the intelligence headquarters was opened up. I mean it wasn't intentionally, but the point is that there was nobody guarding it, and also people got word that the internal security forces were burning records, and so the people rushed there, broke in. And started grabbing records, looking for their own records. Some of them found their own records and were of course shocked to find what they saw. Some elements of internal security are in disarray, but others are certainly still there. There are still intelligence agents running around the streets. But the only thing is that because the military is now in command. They can't do anything, and still, people are getting arrested, people are getting beaten up, but it's not something that is systematic, like it was before under Mubarak. So what another demand of the protesters is to thoroughly dismantle the old apparatus, because you can't reform it, and establish a new people's security force. Yes.
Can you say more about how the labor movement was functioning? You said it was like controlled by the government, mm-hmm. the top apparatus. Mm-hmm. Later on, when just regular white rank and file workers wanted to support the movement, did they have to fight the bureaucrats, or what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the labor movement. What happened is that from 2008. I should say that, I mean, not only in 2008, I mean, even in the past 10 years, there have been, thousands of actual small, strike actions. And of course, all of these actions are effectively in defiance of the law. So they're effectively independent actions, even though there may not be, formally independent trade unions. But one thing that happened during the uprising was that some of the labor unions in Suez and in Bursaid and in some of the other towns in the Nile Delta, started, you know, declaring that, okay, we're independent. We're not going to follow the General Federation of Trade Unions. And then, of course, more recently, they've openly come and declared that, okay, we are independent. We are an independent trade union, and you know, we report to nobody. And you know, now there's no sanction against that. So many of these trade unions are in fact functioning independently right now. And of course the military is very worried about that. They are not in a position to clamp down on it, but they're also, you know, these periodic warnings that, okay, don't go on strike, you know, we need to get the economy going again, and trying to put the brakes on that. But it's not going to stop, because I mean there are tremendous economic pressures that the workers are under, and as the economy is going to be pressure from the IMF and the World Bank to open up more, and you know, globalization is going to eventually take its toll on Egyptian industry. So the workers are insisting on their right to organize. Yes?
What's the feeling in Egypt, especially among the ones that carry out the revolution, toward the Western intervention in Libya? And how much is the struggle in Egypt being affected by what's happened in the other countries, the resistance that's now being offered by the regime?
Well, I don't actually have a lot of direct information about. I know that there is some assistance that is being given to the rebels in Libya, just because of the geographic proximity, and because there are land routes there, although it's a long desert. But so there's an opportunity for Egypt to be of assistance to the Libyan rebels. As far as uprisings elsewhere, I think that Egyptians, both the government and the protesters, are too caught up in their own struggles. I mean, there's an outbreak of everybody's involved in some kind of a meeting, just discussing the future of the country, and you know, earlier it was the discussions about the constitutional referendum. You know, strategies for dealing with that, and you know, whether or not and the connection between the constitutional referendum and trying to delay the elections because the opposition, the youth opposition in particular, doesn't have time to organize. People really want to focus on. I mean, their plates are full. So I don't think that Egyptians are going to have a great deal of impact on or thinking about what's happening elsewhere, but what is happening in Egypt is having an impact, just because of this, you know, the demonstration effect. I mean, if it had only happened in Tunisia, Tunisia was certainly a spark. People said that when they started thinking about coming out into the streets in late January, you know, Tunisia was on their minds. So there's no doubt that Tunisia played a role, but Egypt, being a country that is 12, 13 times the size of Tunisia, is going to have is the gorilla in the room, at least in the Arab world, and it is really Egypt that really has given a tremendous impulse to the uprisings elsewhere.
I was wondering particularly about the attitude toward the Western intervention.
Oh, the Western intervention. I'm sorry. The people, you know, there are differences of opinion. There are differences of opinion here, even among progressives, as to what the attitude should be. But I think there's a lot of concern about a Western intervention, because what happens, even though it may work in favor for now of a pro-democracy movement, there is a risk, and in fact we've seen it, that it's there's mission creep, and it's going to have a logic of its own, and the people of Libya are going to lose control. I think we're already seeing that. So, but it's again, there's a spectrum of opinion, and it's hard to characterize it in one sentence.
One interesting video clip that was going around, I think it was from Al Jazeera in English, one of the youth groups, and I think maybe the guy with the broken nose was part of it, if I remember correctly, but talking about the organizing and leading up beforehand, and they mentioned, for instance, somebody actually went to Serbia and was trained by the activists there that had helped overthrow Milosevic nonviolently, and this kind of thing was going on. And I heard when I was in Bil Ain in the West Bank a month ago, there was an Egyptian woman novelist who had been in Tahrir Square, and she was commenting that people in Egypt were very aware of Bilain's long, every week nonviolent demonstrations, and that was an inspiration to them. So I think there's a lot of, despite the relatively low internet penetration in terms of owned computers, there seems to be a lot of knowledge of what's going on elsewhere in the world, and communication, cross-fertilization, so to speak.
Red Honda, somebody's red Honda. Somebody's car sitting right here.
I was wondering if you might comment on current communication between Egyptians and Palestinians. Current communication between Egyptians and Palestinians, and maybe speculate on the future relations of Egyptians to the Palestinian struggle.
Oh, talk to me?
Well, we can go ahead if you want to.
I don't know any specifics, but I know they're watching, the Palestinians are watching what's going on in Egypt, and as I said, there was some influence in the other direction, but I really can't say beyond that.
No, I can only, I don't have much specifics, but I can just say this is an issue that arose many times in my conversations in Tahrir. Was that people would raise the question of U.S. support for Israel? So it's on people's minds, the opening of the Rafah border is going to increase the interchange between Egyptians and Palestinians, and so I just expect that that is going to continue. To expand, and all these openings. I mean, the very fact that there is a new agreement between Hamas and Fatah is not just because of internal Palestinian politics. It's also because this was brokered in Cairo, and this could not. The point is that under Mubarak, Mubarak would never have brokered such an agreement because Israel would not have wanted that, and so that this is why the situation is opening up, and we're seeing all these developments.
Another question.
I'm sorry. I'm going to let you ask a question, and I will. And then let's break up because it's getting late, and Sherrod and Maxine, and also buy a copy of Maxine's book. She probably autographed it for you without an extra charge. I'm happy.
Yep, my question is, you showed in the images there some of the U.S. weapons that were used, the tear gas canister and the other. And I've been reading about these active denial weapons that are like microwave beams that are directed at protesters that just are totally debilitating. And I think it's used in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I wonder if it's used there. And this technology of the wireless is double-edged sword. People communicate, but they're also dying of cancer and other diseases. And it's also surveillance, like if people are organizing and they're on the cell phones. Those you're trying to oppose who are authoritarian, can they can spy on that and surveillance. Do you have any comments
yes.
on that?
Yes.
And I have an article here from GQ warning your cell phone may be hazardous to your health. So very well researched. It's death technology, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, we did not see the microwave, that microwave weapon in Egypt. So I don't think they have it yet.
Yeah.
As far as the phone technology, obviously, I mean, this is a prime concern because with the access that people accidentally had to the records in state intelligence, they know that the intelligence services in Egypt had very extensive records of what people were seeing over their mobile phones. And so one of the concerns that a lot of activists have now is that even though the intelligence services are cut down partly to size, there's still tremendous concern that they want to have secure means of communication, both by internet and through encryption, as well as some means of doing so for voice. And but that's a major concern, correct? By the way, I also have a book that back there, which I didn't author the whole book, but I authored one chapter in the book on studies in inequality and social justice. So you're welcome to take a look.
One more question. Any comments on just
directed
to both of you? And I would like to also apologize to Sharat for neglecting to mention the book that he just mentioned. And also there's some other items on sale which he brought from the San Jose Peace and Justice Section Center. And so my question is to both of you is I would like to know your opinions on the US and NATO attacks on Libya.
I'm kind of baffled by it. I mean, the U.S. was talking as if it was supposed to be protecting the Libyan people from Gaddafi's forces, and they end up, this kind of thing has happened before. I think it happened in Serbia and other places. So the U.S. says that they're protecting, and they end up with people being victims of the bombing. I don't think that's the way to do things. What can I say? I'm against war anyway. But this kind of going in pretending to be helping and then hurting people just doesn't make sense to me.
Here. And this campaign was justified, and if you look at the UN resolution 1976, what it calls for is a no-fly zone, and what we're seeing is not shooting down aircraft or preventing aircraft from taking off, but bombing the ground. It has nothing to do with a no-fly zone. But the more important thing to look at is motivation, and the best insight you can get into motivation is not the words that are spoken, but by the actions. That why is there a difference between the treatment of Libya versus the treatment of Bahrain or Yemen or Egypt, okay, or even Syria? I mean, in Syria they have now applied sanctions on Syria, okay. Why are there no sanctions on Bahrain or Yemen, right? I mean, none of them, neither Syria nor Yemen have oil. So the oil doesn't explain everything. It has to do with whether or not that government is favorable to so-called U.S. interests.
Okay.